Kurt Smith has joined us here on Sports Byline USA. Again, I want to urge you to check out this wonderful book, Mercy, A Celebration of Fenway Park Centennial, told through Red Sox radio and TV. And this book is about the 100 years of the Red Sox baseball at Fenway Park, told by the announcers of the Red Sox. And that is the element we haven't talked about. Tell me a little bit about going back to the early days, some of the men that were behind the mic describing Red Sox games.
Well, the very first was Fred Hoy, who broadcast the first regular Red Sox games in 1926 and 27. And Ken Coleman, who later broadcast the games of the Boston Red Sox, grew up in Boston listening to Hoy and remember him simply as the man who did the games. And he remembered his pet phrase is, he throws to first and gets his man. And he remembers how, when Hoy was doing games, stores would literally move the cumbersome radios of the day onto the sidewalks next to streets. And cars would be so stunned to hear Fred Hoy announce baseball that they would stop, Ron, in the middle of the street, and cars in back of them would slam into the bumpers. So Fred Hoy would literally be causing one car accident after another. Such was the magic of his appeal. He was then followed by Jim Britt, the literate, erudite announcer of the Boston Red Sox in the 1940s. He was then followed by Kurt Gowdy, the Sox announcer from 1951 through 65, who I think really became not simply the extended member of the family that predecessors became as well, but I think became the man that evolved into a paradigm of how generations thought that a baseball broadcast should become. I can almost think of Jack Webb saying, just the facts, ma'am, because that's what Gowdy gave you. And he almost never made a mistake. He did his homework. He was very close to the ball players. He and Williams were extraordinarily close. Gowdy once told me that he thought that Williams was the most competent man he ever met. He said he's obviously the greatest hitter who ever lived. He said he thought that Gowdy, or that Williams rather, was the greatest fisherman he ever saw, greatest hunter he ever saw. In 1988, they had a 70th birthday celebration for Williams' birthday. And John Glenn was there, the astronaut and United States senator. And Gowdy goes up to him and says, Senator, why are you here? What's your connection to Williams? And Glenn says, I flew planes during the Korean War. And, of course, Gowdy knew that Williams had too. So Gowdy says, well, Senator, what kind of pilot was Williams? And Glenn said, he's the best pilot I ever saw. So that was Williams, and that was Gowdy. And that, and Tom Yawkey, the Red Sox owner during the time, was in many ways the best owner in baseball. So even though the Red Sox of the 1950s and early 60s were certainly a pedestrian team in many ways, they were a franchise of giants. Williams, until he retired in 1960, Tom Yawkey, and of course Kurt Gowdy, a wonderful age in which to be a Red Sox fan.
Kurt, when you think over the long history of the broadcasters, the men that have been behind the mic of the Red Sox broadcasts, is there any commonality among them all?
Yeah, none of them thought that they were bigger than the game. As I point out in Mercy, some franchises like it just fine when a broadcaster is more surpassing than his team. Harry Carey, for example, surpassed his club in both Chicago and in St. Louis, and fans liked it just great. That would not have been the case in Boston. Carey would not have been accepted, as amazing as that sounds, in New England. But boy, Gowdy never made the mistake of thinking that he was bigger than the old town team. Ned Martin in the 60s and 70s and 80s broadcast the Sox, a franchise record 32 straight years. He was a poet. He was an American literature major. He would quote Shakespeare in times of Sox ineptitude. He would say, quoting the bard, when sorrows come, they come not as times, not as single spies, but in battalions. Please tell me the last time that you heard anyone quote William Shakespeare. He would quote from Hemingway or quote from Faulkner. You had Ken Coleman, as I mentioned, and he would use his voice like Yasha Heifetz did a violin. Later on, you would had Jim Woods, who with Ned Martin formed the greatest radio tandem that I have ever heard. You had John Miller, who began his career really in Boston. A lot of people don't know that, and began his gift for mimicry. To this day, as you know, Ron, he does a better Vin Scully than Scully, and he does them in English, Spanish, and Japanese. He never thought that he was bigger than the Sox. And so you have this disarming and frankly refreshing propensity of many broadcasters in this age of egomania today never to think of themselves as bigger, if you would, than the region's team itself.
One of the things that I have noted, and one of the stops along the way in my broadcasting career, was in Boston. And when I think about their announcers, they are not announcers of just Boston. They are announcers of all of New England.
Yes.
What have the New England sports fans come to expect out of their Red Sox announcers?
The facts, and nothing but the facts. 1951, Kurt Gowdy leaves New York. He had been Mal Allen's assistant. He goes to Boston. He asked Tom Yawkey, "Mr. Yawkey, how do you want the game?" And Yawkey says, "Don't embellish. Don't try to jazz up a fly ball. New England fans are too smart. They've had the Braves here, the National League team, then since 1876. They've had the Red Sox here since 1901. They know their baseball. Just give it to them straight." And you know what Red Sox announcers have? I think it starts with this fact, and I try not to be at all biased here, because I would say the same thing if I were a fan of the Oakland A's. Really, you talk to announcers from any team and they will tell you that fans of the Boston Red Sox are very probably the most encyclopedic and the most studious. They know their baseball better than probably any team in all of baseball. You can't fool them. And Red Sox announcers don't try. And so I think it starts with that. And that can be true in Boston. It could be true in the Red Sox far-flung 70 affiliate station in the six New England states, and in the tiny little poetic church steeple towns that I love so well in the six New England states, where radio and the wireless is really their connecting tissue, their umbilical cord, if you would, to the Red Sox. And it's just, you know, it's such a romantic franchise in that sense. Let me put it this way. If every franchise were like the Boston Red Sox, you and I wouldn't be debating today which sport were indeed the national pastime.
You know as well as I do, there was a long period of futility for the Boston Red Sox until they finally did win a championship again in the 2000s. And I'm just wondering about how difficult it was for the announcers to criticize a team that many fans loved.
Not at all, because Mal Allen once delineated the distinction for me as well as any announcer I've ever heard. He was the Yankee announcer, and he was often accused of being a homer, and he said, "No, I'm not." He said, "I'm partisan but not prejudiced. A partisan announcer wants his team to win but gives equal credit to both teams." He said, "A prejudiced announcer gives credit only to one tiny team." He said, "I want the Yankees to win, obviously. They pay my paycheck. But I give equal credit to each team." And that was true of a Gowdy, or of a John Miller, or of a Coleman, or of a Martin. And they could be critical. I mean, how could you not be critical of a Dick Stewart, for example? Dr. Strangelove, the Red Sox pathetic fielding first baseman in the 1960s. Gowdy once affirmed that this story did indeed happen. In 1963, Dick Stewart did indeed get a standing ovation at Fenway Park for picking up a hot dog wrapper without dropping it. Now, how could Gowdy not be critical of him? And he was.
We only have 90 seconds left, but what do you want readers of this fine book to take away from it?
The romance of the Red Sox, and how I think the Sox understand baseball, and how the Sox announcers understand what makes the game and what the DNA of the game is, and what the Red Sox understand about the game that if each other team in baseball did, would, I think, enhance the game's appeal as well. And that includes Fenway Park. If you're watching a game on television, for example, there's not a bad television angle, a bad camera angle from Fenway. So if each team would look at what the Red Sox did right, there would be a lot less today that baseball does wrong.
In the minute that we have left, because of your fervor, your passion, and familiarity with the Red Sox, was this an easy or a hard book for you to write?
Yes, it was both. It was a challenging book because it was a personal book, but it was a book that because of the internet and the computer, you can edit and re-edit and edit again. So I was able, I hope at least, to winnow, as we will, and re-edit into the kind of a tight writing that I had hoped. And in the end, you know, I'm pretty pleased with the product. The sales have been good, and the reviews have been very kind. And after all, it's dedicated to my mother, so I had to make it good.
In about 30 seconds, is there a particular nugget after all the research that you come away with that makes Kurt Smith smile?
I think Gowdy's call of Ted Williams' final home run in 1960, Williams exiting as only a deity can, and Gowdy telling me this was not in his call, but he told me off air. He said it was unbelievable. My heart was pounding. It was as emotional as a heart can get. Now, if that doesn't make your heart stir, I don't know what does, because it makes mine.
Another great book from you, Kurt. Thank you for sharing the book and also the memories. Take care, Kurt.
Ron, thank you.
Fine, noted baseball broadcast historian Kurt Smith with us, and I hope you'll check out this wonderful book. It's called Mercy, A Celebration of Fenway Park Centennial, told through Red Sox radio and TV. We take a break, come back on the other side, continue across the country and around the world with you on Sports Byline.